This podcast is brought to you by ClearBridge Investments. Meet an evolving economy confidently with ClearBridge Active Equities, the foundation of a resilient portfolio. ClearBridge, a Franklin Templeton company. Go to clearbridge.com to learn more.
Please stay tuned for important disclosure information at the conclusion of this episode.
Hi, and welcome to The Long View. I'm Christine Benz, Director of Personal Finance for Morningstar, Inc.
And I'm Jeff Patak, Global Director of Manager Research for Morningstar Research Services.
Our guest on the podcast today is tax and retirement planning expert Jeffrey Levine. Jeff is the lead financial planning nerd, and yes, that's his official title, at Kitsis.com, home of the popular Nerd's Eye View blog. He is also the CEO and Director of Financial Planning for Blueprint Wealth Alliance. Previously, Jeff served as Chief Retirement Strategist at Ed Slott & Company. He has authored several books, including The Baby Boomer's Guide to Savvy IRA Planning, The Financial Advisor's Guide to Savvy IRA Planning, and The Definitive Guide to Required Minimum Distributions for Baby Boomers. Jeff is a frequent public speaker and media commentator, and he maintains a high profile on social media and on the Nerd's Eye View blog, where he readily shares tax and retirement planning insights. We're thrilled to have him join us on the podcast today. Jeff, welcome to The Long View.
Thanks so much for having me.
So we have lots of nitty-gritty questions about retirement and tax planning and the SECURE Act that just passed through Congress. But before we get into them, let's talk about how you occupy your time. So let's start with what you're doing for Kitsis.com.
Sure. So I basically spend my time nerding out, and that's kind of how we arrived at my title, which is lead financial planning nerd. It is literally my job to, you know, dive through any matters, whether it be financial planning issues, tax issues, estate planning issues, and to really dive into them as deep as can be so that we can give readers a solid breakdown of a topic. You know, our typical blog will run anywhere from, you know, 2,500 to sometimes 5,000 words on a fairly narrow topic. And so we really try to go deep into the area and provide full context and background so that people can make educated decisions.
Okay. And then you also do a fair amount of educating advisors as well.
Yeah, I love teaching. That's, teaching, I think in another life, I probably would have been a teacher. It's just a lot of fun. And, you know, it really helps you connect to the end users and by speaking to those advisors who then can go out and impact, you know, hundreds of lives or thousands of lives, depending upon how many you're speaking to at once. You know, that's a good sense of satisfaction out of that.
Right. So at Blueprint Wealth Alliance, you're actually involved in engaging with clients, correct? Your own clients?
Correct.
Okay.
Yes, the end user. Yep.
Okay.
Exactly.
So what's your demographic there at Blueprint? Do you have a typical sort of client profile?
Yeah, you know, I'd say our typical client is kind of like the millionaire next door, very, you know, humble individual who has done a really good job saving. And, you know, they're now in this final stretch of their life where they're trying to figure out not only how do I protect and preserve the assets that I have, how do I minimize taxation, how do I make sure that I not only can enjoy my lifetime, because most of them have done such a good job saving that, you know, they know they'll be okay, but it's how do I transition this effectively and how do I educate my children or grandchildren or whatnot, so that we can preserve this family legacy. Because as you know, most families' wealth is kind of squandered within a few generations, and they know that. So they're really mindful of how do we encourage our children or our heirs to have the same types of good habits that we did and that got us to this point to begin with.
Many advisors seem to have chosen a single business model. Maybe they're hourly or AUM based, but your firm actually offers both as well as a per project fee. How do you help clients figure out the right business model for them?
You know, it's really just sitting down with them and understanding a little bit about what they're looking for and what their goals are. For a lot of people, they're looking for that ongoing, you know, consistent presence in their lives of a, you know, a kind of cliche at this point, but like the personal CFO, if you will. And other people are just really looking for a quick answer to a situation like, hey, I've heard all about these conversions. Does that make sense for me? Or, you know, I have this one-time question. How do I go about answering that? And so, you know, I don't believe that there's any one-size-fits-all solution. And so we want to be able to help people regardless of the way they come to us.
So this podcast is a little bit of a departure for us in that we're trying to be timely, and we want to talk specifically about the SECURE Act. You've really put yourself out there as an expert on all things SECURE Act since its passage. So let's start with, I think, what is one of the most notable aspects of the act, which is the death of the stretch IRA. So before we get into what's changing, let's just talk about when the Stretch IRA was alive and well. Let's talk about how that worked and then get into what has changed for many beneficiaries who inherit IRAs from here on out.
So prior to the SECURE Act, and also going forward for a select group of beneficiaries, which, as you mentioned, we can get into in just a bit, the default when you had a named living, breathing person on your beneficiary form, like a child, a grandchild, really anybody, was that they could take out the inherited IRA or inherited 401k, kind of using inherited IRA here as kind of an umbrella term for all retirement assets. But those retirement assets were able to be distributed by those heirs over their lifetime in kind of small installments, if you will. So for argument's sake, a 40-year-old beneficiary would have to start taking out only about 2.5% of the account balance each year. And what that did was it accomplished two goals for those beneficiaries. First is that it kept their income lower from year to year so that they wouldn't push themselves into a higher tax bracket or phase themselves out of credits or deductions or push themselves into an area where they'd be subject to surtaxes, et cetera, right? All the bad things that can happen when we add more income to a tax return. The second thing it did was it allowed as much money as possible to remain in those inherited IRAs, growing tax deferred. So avoiding the taxation on the interest, the dividends, the capital gains that would accrue each year, and basically extend that for what would be their life expectancy. Now, an IRS determined life expectancy, so one that was the same regardless of a 40-year-old who was, you know, sadly, you know, terminally ill, or a 40-year-old who was running marathons each month. But it was a standard time where we would often be able to preserve the tax benefits of an account for literally decades.
So from a practical standpoint, have you seen any data on what percentage of people inheriting IRAs were actually taking advantage of this Stretch IRA provision? Was it sort of concentrated among generally wealthy people? That's sort of what I would expect.
That's exactly right. It's simply, if you can't afford to stretch, then, you know, there are really three individuals who decided not to stretch. Those who could not afford to stretch, right, which is the overwhelming majority of people. Those who simply did not know any better, you know, maybe they could have afforded to, but they didn't have the right guidance. They were never told of the benefits of the Stretch IRA or even perhaps that it existed, just lack of education. And then the last group, which was the group that perhaps could have afforded to stretch and knew enough, but still decided for whatever reason not to do so. So maybe they decided to accelerate distributions from the account to pay for a child's education as opposed to having the child take loans. Or maybe they decided to, you know, finally build that extension onto the house that they'd been waiting decades to do or something like that. So when you put all that together, no, the overwhelming majority of people didn't stretch. And it was really a key benefit for that high income or high net worth beneficiary who could afford and also knew enough to benefit from that stretch to do so. It was an option, right? It's the required minimum distribution that had to come out each year, not a maximum. And so that optionality gave people the ability to either decide to accelerate distributions from the account and, you know, potentially pay tax at a higher rate, but gather those assets out of the account sooner, or to potentially defer them for future use at a lower rate.
So can you talk about what's changed for many beneficiaries with the passage of the SECURE Act?
Sure. So before the passage of the SECURE Act, broadly speaking, you might think of it as having two groups of beneficiaries. There were non-designated beneficiaries and designated beneficiaries. So two broad categories. And the first one we've already talked about, designated beneficiaries. That was that category of living, breathing, you know, people who would be able to stretch over a life expectancy, as we just mentioned. Then there was that second category of non-designated beneficiaries, which had even more strict and severe rules in terms of taking out the money from the account, oftentimes in just as little as 5 years, depending upon when death occurred. Going forward, that group of designated beneficiaries who were potentially able to stretch distributions for, you know, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years, or even more in some cases, you know, some grandchildren were able to stretch for, you know, literally 70 years potentially or more. That is going to be reduced to a 10-year window. And instead of working like the traditional inherited IRA distributions where the minimum would be a specific amount each and every year, instead that 10-year window functions as kind of an end point. But during the 10 years, you can do whatever you want. So if for argument's sake, an individual passed away today and left money to an adult child, you know, let's say 30 years of age, that adult child, beginning in 2021, a 10-year window would start. So 2021 would be year one, 2022 would be year two, et cetera. And from years 1 through 9, there's no required minimum amount. You can take whatever you want. Voluntary distributions are just that, voluntary. But in year 10, whatever would be left in that account has to be entirely distributed by the end of the year in order to avoid a penalty. And so what we end up with is a situation where for most people, it will make sense to spread those distributions out over, you know, the 10 years or at least a larger portion of it. But for some individuals, maybe they don't use the full 10 years. For argument's sake, if we think about when, you know, the typical boomer is going to, you know, pass away, let's say late 70s, 80s, early 90s, somewhere in that range, you know, their children might be late 50s, 60s, maybe they're kind of on the brink of retirement, if you will. And if we imagine that a 60, you know, two-year-old inherits an IRA from a parent, and now they're in a situation where they have to take out everything in 10 years, maybe that 62-year-old is going to retire at 65. That individual might decide, in essence, to take small distributions or maybe no distributions at all in the year that they're 62, 63, 64, 65 while they're retired, and then to spread out the distributions in the remaining 6 years of that 10-year window, right? That would be one option. And frankly, that's going to be a real planning consideration for those beneficiaries going forward is, when do I want to take the money out of this account, balancing not only the money that's coming out of the IRA, but also with the other tax attributes they have, how much other income they have from other sources, whether it be work or interest dividends, and what their other deductions and credits look like, et cetera. Not so much different than the Roth IRA conversion decision as to when people should take that income, but for the fact that the Roth is always an option, where here, by the end of the 10th year, it's coming out one way or another, or you're paying a steep penalty.
So let's talk about for whom it's kind of business as usual if they inherit IRAs. It sounds like spouses, basically, it's the same as it was before. But let's talk about that group of people for whom there's really no change.
Sure. That's that third group of individuals that are created. Again, kind of going back and recapping, in the old rules, we had non-designated beneficiaries and designated beneficiaries. Going forward, we have non-designated beneficiaries. Designated beneficiaries who go from that old lifetime distribution down to the 10-year rule we just discussed. And then we go to a new category that's brand new, created by the SECURE Act, called eligible designated beneficiaries. And the way to just think about that is they're eligible to continue stretching distributions as if the SECURE Act had never occurred in the first place. So that group consists of five different subcategories, if you will. The first one you already mentioned, which is surviving spouses. The second would be disabled individuals. The third would be chronically ill persons. And both disability and chronically ill are definitions or are defined in the tax code and fairly rigidly, particularly with respect to disability. For argument's sake, disability is not in the tax code or for purposes of this rule, is not like a surgeon who cut his finger and now he can't do surgery anymore.
Right.
The disability definition is one that requires somebody be unable to engage in any substantially gainful activity, and that impairment should be expected to be indefinite or result in their death, right? So fairly, you know, rigid rules.
Right.
That's that second and third group. Then we get to the fourth category, which is beneficiaries who are not more than 10 years younger than the IRA decedent themselves. And that could be anyone. It could be a friend, it could be a brother or sister or a cousin, et cetera. But anyone who's within 10 years of the decedent's age, they get to continue stretching. And then the final one is the decedent's minor children. And I just want to emphasize real quick that one word there, the decedent's minor children. The reason why I want to really hit that hard is because since the SECURE Act has been passed, I've seen a lot of inaccurate information being presented to people that it's an exception for minor children. The reality is it's not any minor child. It has to be the owner's minor child. So for instance, if a grandparent decided, I'm going to leave my IRA or my Roth IRA to my grandkids, they would have the 10-year window because they're not the decedent's minor child. They're just a minor child. And what's also different about that last group of beneficiaries, that decedent's minor children category, is that unlike the first four groups we just mentioned, the spouses, the disabled persons, the chronically ill persons, and the individuals within that 10-year age window, they have a permanent exemption, if you will, from the SECURE Act's new rules. They can stretch as if the SECURE Act didn't take place essentially for the balance of their lives. Whereas the decedent's minor children, they only have a temporary reprieve. They only get the stretch rules that existed prior until they hit the age of majority, which is anywhere from as young as 18 in some states to as high as 26 in some places, if that individual is still like in school, for instance. And then once they hit that age of majority, it switches over from the old stretch rules to the new 10-year window. So they get a temporary break. Everybody else gets a permanent break.
And this doesn't affect anyone who had already inherited an IRA and was using the stretch. Is that correct?
That's right. And more specifically to decedents who passed away prior to the start of 2020. So one of the questions that's come in here now is, as the years kind of started with relatively high frequency, is like, hey, I knew somebody who passed away in December of last year, but you know, the kids didn't get a chance to set up the inherited IRA before the end of the year because, you know, it happened late in the year, or they were busy with holidays, or for whatever reason. That's fine. It's not based on when the inherited IRA was set up. It's based on when death occurred. And actually, there's a few exceptions to the start date of January 1st of 2020 for certain investors. For instance, there's a specific exception that ties to annuities that were already annuitized over life expectancy. The new Secure Act rules don't apply there. And also for collectively bargained and governmental plans, things like a thrift savings plan or a 403B or a 457 plan established by a state or local government, for instance, like for teachers, those plans don't kill the stretch, if you will, until January 1st of 2022 as a default. So individuals there have a few more years potentially. And the good news is that they've got two extra years of, you know, potential for their heirs to stretch, whereas it might be lost otherwise. The bad news is, in order to kind of take advantage of that, they have to die. So right. not a particularly wonderful planning strategy.
So, Jeff, you referenced a planning strategy or sort of a set of planning thoughts that inheritors should think about in terms of kind of harmonizing that 10-year window with their own tax situation. But let's think about it from the standpoint of the account owner, because it seems that there are planning considerations here. If you were, say, set to leave your IRAs to your children, there are some new dimensions to this with the stretch off the table. So let's talk about that for people who are earmarking beneficiaries of their IRAs. What are the planning considerations for them?
Sure. I think you hit it on the head, is people who are earmarking some of this money for their heirs. Because I think you've got kind of two categories of people that you're going to run across. And I've kind of started to see this over the last few weeks. And the first category is that group that says, you know what, if I live to my life expectancy or a pretty good lifetime, I'm going to enjoy most of my retirement assets. If I die early, my kids will get something, potentially a lot of money, but I'm planning on enjoying my retirement during my retirement. And if I happen to die early and my kids step into a, you know, a ton of money and they have to pay a higher tax on it than they otherwise would have before this law, you know, so be it. No one left me anything, right? And so they'll have something. And you have kind of some people in that camp. And then you get others who say, you know, I've worked my whole life, I've sacrificed, I've, you know, all to save these dollars. And I'll be darned if, you know, the government is going to see one more dollar of tax than they have to, not only over my lifetime, but over my kids' lifetime too. And so I'm interested in making sure that collectively we pay as little as tax, even if it means I pay a little more during my lifetime. And so there is a number of potential options that individuals can look at. One of the first things would be, does this accelerate Roth conversions during lifetime? And to some degree, it probably should. I don't think it means that everybody should convert everything to a Roth IRA right away. But if we're looking at when it makes sense to convert to a Roth, it's essentially when you believe you'll be paying the lowest tax rate. You know, at what point in your life do you have the lowest possible tax rate? And if we're looking at leaving this money to, you know, to children or to other heirs down the line, it's not just your tax rate, it's, you know, your kids' tax rate. And so kind of going back to the issue that we spoke about before, if you've got a parent who's going to pass away and leave a IRA to an individual who's kind of in peak earning years, well, that's the last time you want to be paying tax on all that money, you know, especially at an accelerated rate. So we could see situations where, you know, mom or dad decide to convert more because it's more cost effective for them. Or maybe it's a situation where the kids, if they're successful enough, can even gift mom or dad money to convert, you know, at their lower rates, especially if they are older and they have maybe substantial medical deductions in some cases that can offset the income. There's a lot of planning that could be done there. And there's certainly options that, you know, there's other options to consider too. It's just all a balancing game. For instance, there's a lot of chatter right now about potentially replacing the stretch with a charitable trust. That's one option that's being floated about rather consistently. And there's some merit to that. A charitable remainder trust, for instance, can replicate a lot of the benefits of a stretch IRA, creating a stream of income that would come out from this trust over an individual's life expectancy, et cetera. The challenge, though, is that, you know, there are downsides to that. There is no, you know, silver bullet. There's no one-size-fits-all strategy. And while that charitable trust, you know, let's say you left your IRA to this charitable trust to replicate the stretch because that's really what you wanted for your children. Well, the downsides of that, first off, is that they lose optionality.
Right.
If with the stretch IRA, you could take whatever you want, whenever you want. As we talked about, most people don't stretch. With the charitable trust, it's basically locked in stone. It's very difficult to break into a charitable trust and to get more than the income that's otherwise you would be entitled to each year. And the second issue is, like, what happens when that income beneficiary dies with a charitable trust? The balance goes to, you know, a charity. That's the whole point. That's why you get the great tax breaks. But what if, you know, dad dies and the beneficiary is a charitable trust for the benefit of, you know, the dad's son? And on the way to, you know, the funeral, dad's son gets into a car accident and dies. And now dad's son's daughter, right, the grandchild of the original decedent, doesn't have anything potentially because the remainder of the account, which was basically the whole thing, got, you know, sent to charity.
Right.
Can you, you know, mitigate this with life insurance or other things? Sure, there's always options, but every upside carries a downside. And it's just a matter of weighing which option is best for individuals, kind of laying them all out on the table and saying, of these, which of these benefits are most important to you and which of these drawbacks are most important to you to avoid?
Do you have a thought on, say, a parent has children who are adults, but maybe young adults, say early 20s or something like that, and they're a little concerned about them coming into a large sum of money and they liked the sort of RMD aspect of the inherited IRA. What's your thought on kind of troubleshooting that risk of a young person really blowing through the money more quickly than would be ideal?
You know, it's a really, really good question, and it's a tremendous challenge in the current system. There's like no really good answer because on one hand, you could just leave it to them outright and you're subjecting them to, you know, potential risk of being a spendthrift or, you know, even other things. If God forbid they, you know, have a car accident or something like that, or they get divorced. There's other issues, you know, that where some of those dollars could, you know, be lost, if
right.
you will. But the only way to truly and really to really protect those dollars is to leave them to a trust. And that creates all sorts of other complications and potential added costs, not just the drafting of the trust itself, but for instance, any money that stays inside a trust that's not passed out to the trust beneficiaries gets taxed at trust tax rates. And for 2020, that starts the highest rate of 37% for a trust starts at $12,950. You or I don't get to the highest rate until we have more than $500,000 or $600,000 of taxable income, depending upon our filing status. So even a modest IRA, especially if everything is coming out in just 10 years, can probably spit out more than $10,000 or $12,950 per year, making most of that distribution potentially subject at that highest 37% tax rate if it stays in the trust. Now, someone could certainly argue, well, Jeff, if I have a spendthrift child and I pass it out to them, they might just spend it all. And so having half of it lost to taxes if it stays in the trust and is preserved is better for me. And then other people will look at it and say, I don't want to see half my money eroded in taxes. Maybe I'll make sure the trustee passes it out to the beneficiary each year. You know, this way they pay it at their own rate or so forth. So, you know, it goes back, unfortunately, you know, I wish I could just say everybody should do this. That
right.
would make life so much easier for all of us. Right? But it really is one of those things where you might spend hours talking about this with your financial advisor, your CPA, your estate planning attorney to really get to what is ultimately the best solution. And in some cases, it may be a combination thereof. Maybe some money is left to the trust for more preservation, but perhaps with more draconian tax consequences, right? But you leave some money outright to the kids. This way, if they want to spend some money sooner, they can. You know, it doesn't have to be an all or nothing type of situation.
Another big change is that the new start date for required minimum distributions from IRAs and company retirement plan assets is moving out to 72. So first, let's talk about what RMDs are and why people have to take them.
Sure. So RMD, short for required minimum distribution, it's a stated amount that essentially the tax code says you must remove from your retirement account. And the whole point of that is at a certain point, the government wants its tax dollars, right? You've gotten a tax break for X number of years, but at some point, you know, the chickens come to roost and you have to pay that bill. And so required minimum distribution is simply the amount that the, you know, Congress has decided needs to come out of your account so that we can either pay taxes on that money, or in the case of a Roth, you know, end the special tax treatment that you have otherwise received. In terms of why it needs to happen, very simply put, you know, that's the rule. That's what Congress put in the law. And it is part of every single retirement account with the exception of the Roth IRA. So every other retirement account out there has required minimum distributions. Even Roth 401ks and Roth 403bs have required minimum distributions. The Roth IRA is the lone exception to that rule. And once those assets get passed on to, you know, like a non-spouse heir or whatnot, they typically do have required minimum distributions that must start even for inherited Roth IRAs. So it's a kind of a basic framework of the rules. And as you mentioned, the SECURE Act kind of pushes that starting point out for RMDs out to 72 from its previous point of 70 and a half for most individuals.
So what drove that change? I know retirees, affluent retirees, love to hate their RMDs, but what were sort of the considerations that Congress looked at when pushing that number out?
Simply that more people are working later, life expectancies are getting longer, so maybe we should delay having these required minimum distributions come out. Frankly, it's another one of those provisions that's in the SECURE Act that really benefits a very small percentage of the American population. Last year, Congress actually put out proposed regulations to change the life expectancy tables for required minimum distributions. And when they did that, they said, we really don't think this is going to be a big deal in terms of lowering our revenue. We're seeing people take out a lot less from their IRA simply because the overwhelming majority of people are not taking distributions based on their required minimum distribution. In other words, they're taking distributions based on how much they need to live.
Right.
The fact that they have an RMD that might be less doesn't mean anything if they need to live on that money. And so pushing back required minimum distributions from 70.5 to 72, again, is nice if you can afford to wait. It'll certainly give high income and high net worth investors another year or two potentially to do Roth conversions, perhaps at what would otherwise be low income years, since there's no required minimum distributions that have started yet. But at the same point, it's not going to be a big deal for the vast majority of Americans who are already taking out money anyway. If you tell somebody they don't have to take 5% out of their IRA at 71, but they need 5% to live on, you know, telling you don't have to take it out doesn't really change anything.
So, Jeff, there's been some talk, and you referenced this, about tweaking those life expectancy tables that RMDs are calculated off of. What's the status of that, and could that still go forward? It's not necessarily either or, but it seems like pushing the date out to 72 semi-corrects for longer life expectancies.
So it actually doesn't change the pushing the age out to 72. So it doesn't necessarily change the percentage that has to be withdrawn at each age. So we didn't actually push the old tables back. In other words, like the old 70 age factor doesn't push back to 72.
It's
just that we don't start until 72. Whereas those proposed regulations would actually change the percentage that's required at each of those ages. And as we stand here today, as we record, that's still in a proposed regulation status. However, I strongly suspect that will be finalized before the end of this year in the same or a substantially similar format. It's a regulation, so it's entirely at the IRS's discretion. It's not like we need congressional action, which would, you know, potentially make me change my mind.
Right.
Especially in an election year, you know,
right.
Who knows what's going to happen this year. But from a regulatory perspective, IRS at this point, you know, it's put it out as a proposed regulation. It's asking for commentary. At some point, it's just going to be able to go and say, yep, we're finalizing it. And the proposed effective date of those changes, even though they put it out in 2019, the proposed effective date, even when they put it out then, wasn't until 2021. So while I would never bet my life upon anything with Congress or the IRS or any other government entity, just because you never know, I'd be willing to place a large bet that we'll see those regulations finalized sometime this year in 2020 that do get put into place for 2021. And interestingly enough, the way that they would change that, especially like for most IRA owners who use that uniform lifetime table, the old one that I think started at like 27.4 and then went to 26.5, et cetera.
Right.
The change in that table would actually make the old age 70 factor almost identical to the new age 72 factor. So even though I just said that they didn't push back the RMDs and, you know, they just said we'll start at the age 72 factor, if this gets passed before next year, that's effectively what will end up happening, is we will have pushed back the old table. It comes out to be like a point, you know, a fractional difference in the amount that someone at 72 going forward would be taking compared to what in the past somebody at 70 would have taken.
So this does put a pause on new RMD takers, right? The group of people 7.5 and older that were poised to take RMDs in 2020 will no longer have to do so?
That's right. Only IRA owners who would have had, let's say, a 71st birthday this year, but who turned 70.5 after the start of this year, don't have to take anything until 2022, potentially, like whether they would push it back, or 2021, I'm sorry, for those individuals. Simply put, if you turned 70.5 on or after January 1st, 2020, you get to benefit from the Secure Act's new pushing back of the RMDs. Whereas if you turned 70.5 prior to the start of 2020, you don't. And so some people, for instance, will only be 71 this year, but still have to take a required minimum distribution because they were 70.5 last year. A good example of this would be, you know, take a February 2019 birthday where someone turned 70 years old. Well, they would have turned 70.5 if they turned 70 in February. They would have been 70.5 in August of 2019. And that means they had a first required minimum distribution for 2019. In 2020, that person's only turning 71. And even though RMDs now don't start until 72, and that person is only 71, they must continue taking distributions because their 70.5 birthday was prior to the start of this year.
Let's talk about the qualified charitable distribution first, if you can tell people what it is, and then get into how the Secure Act affects it.
Sure. So the Secure, well, let's start with what it is.
Yeah.
A qualified charitable distribution is frankly one of, if not the best way for certain older retirement savers to give to charity. What it is it's a provision that allows an IRA owner or an IRA beneficiary only, so no plan participants are allowed to do this, just IRA owners and IRA beneficiaries who are themselves 70.5 or older. And that 70.5, interestingly enough, is not the year of. It is actual age 70.5. So an individual must have their 70.5 birthday, if you will, and then they can make these QCDs or qualified charitable distributions, which are distributions that go right from the IRA or inherited IRA directly to charity, or distributions where the check from the IRA is made out to the charity. And the benefit, if you will, of a qualified charitable distribution is that the distribution is never included in income. It is not a deduction on the return, and that sometimes trips people up. And they say,
right,
well, why would I do that if I don't get a deduction? Isn't that the whole point? But it's actually way better than a deduction for two reasons. First off, not everybody can deduct charitable contributions, especially after the Tax Cut and Jobs Act. If we think about a married couple, for instance, who are each 65 or older in 2020, they have a standard deduction this year of $27,400. So even if we give them the maximum amount of state and local taxes that they could possibly have, $10,000, where are they coming up with another $17,400 of itemized deductions? I mean, that's a lot of money. And even some people who are, you know, significantly charitably inclined each year, you give $10,000 more away to charity on top of your state and local taxes of $10,000, that's still only, quote unquote, $20,000, still significantly less than the $24,400 standard deduction. If you don't itemize, you get no tax benefit for giving to charity. So when you take money out of your IRA, even if you later write a check to charity, all you're doing is adding money to your taxable income. And for those out there who do itemize, and they say, well, I guess that doesn't really impact me because I do itemize my tax return. Well, it probably does impact you as well. Because if you think about the way a tax return works, there's kind of a first half of the tax return and a second half of the tax return. And halftime is the AGI, like the halftime score on a tax return.
Right.
And unlike the halftime score of like most football games or any football game really, or any sporting event, it matters, right? Like the halftime score is actually really important on a tax return. You think about AGI and everything that's tied to AGI, things like almost every credit that gets phased out is tied to AGI. All the deductions that get phased out, save for that qualified business income tax deduction, you know, they're all tied to AGI. Even things that aren't part of the tax code, but are keyed to income, like Medicare Part B premiums, for instance, or Part D premiums, and the IRMA adjustments, those income-related monthly adjustment amounts that apply to high-income individuals who are on Medicare. You know, those are all keyed to AGI. So you can actually end up giving $1 billion away to charity. And does that make you a wonderful person? Of course it does. But it doesn't help you reduce any of the costs that are related to AGI, like Medicare, et cetera. You know, Bill Gates could give $1 billion to charity. His IRMA will still be high. He'll still have, you know, an impact on his Medicare because the charitable contribution, even as an itemized deduction, is a like third or fourth quarter, if you will, expense. It happens after halftime. And so it does nothing to change the halftime score and nothing to change the things that are key to that halftime score on the tax return.
Prior to the Secure Act's passage, you couldn't contribute to a traditional IRA after age 70 and a half, but now you can do so at any age. So the question is, why was the stricture removed? It made a certain amount of sense that contributions would have to stop once RMDs begin and that people in that situation would want to favor Roths later in life.
You know, interestingly enough, first off, why they did it is simply to, I think, harmonize it with the other rules. It was the only account that did not allow traditional or any contributions rather after 70 and a half. If we think about all the other types of retirement accounts that are out there, whether it be Roth IRAs or 401ks, 403bs, or even frankly, SEP and simple IRAs, which largely follow the IRA rules in many instances, they all allowed for contributions after age 70 and a half, and even those that had required minimum distributions. So for argument's sake, you know, whereas, you know, you mentioned this kind of a oddity of, yeah, I'm going to contribute to my retirement account, but I also have to take a distribution. That's exactly what has always been the case and continues to be the case for things like SEP IRAs. If you're a 73-year-old, you know, self-employed business owner and you want to contribute to your SEP IRA for the year, no problem. You can do that. But at the same time, you also have to take a required minimum distribution, and it makes no difference whether you're working, not working, a 5% owner, et cetera. Like, for a SEP IRA, you have a required minimum distribution. So it almost becomes a little bit like a revolving door of IRA money, so to speak. Nevertheless, you know, by eliminating that age 70 and a half restriction, it allows individuals who continue to work past 70 to potentially make those contributions to a traditional IRA. Or if they have a spouse who's working, because that's another thing that you can do. You have to have a so-called compensation to be able to make a IRA contribution, which is generally earned income. For most people, it's going to be either W-2 wages or self-employment income. And that's the typical source, if you will, of compensation. But that compensation then can be used to make those IRA contributions. But if you have a spouse who's working and you're not, you can essentially borrow the compensation of your spouse to make a contribution. And that's just considered a spousal IRA contribution. That's the name it's given, or actually has a more formal name now. It's called a K. Bailey Hutchinson IRA contribution. But no one actually calls it that. They still call it the old spousal IRA contribution. And so that's a nice, you know, added benefit, especially for the roughly 30% of 70-year-olds who, you know, who continue to work after that point. So it's not the majority of individuals, but it's still a pretty good section, cross-section of the American populace that does continue to work after age 70. And of course, you know, anytime, you know, Congress giveth, usually Congress taketh. And so along with that elimination of the age at which you can make traditional IRA contributions, Congress also introduced a new anti-abuse rule to kind of prevent people from using those deductions after 70 and a half and then making qualified charitable distributions, that, you know, that tax benefit we just talked about for charity, with the same dollars, if you will.
So, Jeff, let's switch gears a little bit away from IRAs, and I want to quickly hit on the implications of the Secure Act for company retirement plans, starting with what are called open MEPs, or multiple employer plans. First, let's talk about what a MEP is, what a multiple employer plan is, and how the Secure Act could increase the uptake of these things.
Sure. So in short, a MEP is a multiple employer retirement plan, not to be confused with a multi-employer retirement plan. I know that's like so close, but multi-employer plans are completely different. They're organized under a separate section of the code. They're typically like union plans. A multiple employer plan, a MEP, is a single retirement plan where two or more unrelated businesses participate in. They essentially like plug themselves in, if you will, to the MEP. And the potential benefits of the MEP are the same benefits that you get when you go to like Costco, for instance. You know, we have three young children, you know, under the age of 5 and under, and we got a lot of diapers right now in the house. And whenever we need diapers, I get the, hey, we need to go to Costco or BJ's or whatever it is run. And the reason why, of course, is like, it's much cheaper, right? We buy in bulk and we get like 7,000 diapers for the price of 5,000 or something like that.
Right.
And kind of in a similar fashion, like if you have a lot of participants participating in a plan, you should be able to streamline things. You should be able to have pricing in bulk powers. And while certainly investment costs are not as, you know, you can get low cost investments a lot easier today, even for small plans. There's always a power of negotiation when you bring in a large group. So even from a record keeping perspective, if a plan was able to bring, let's say, instead of a 2-person group, they were able to bring 100 3 or 4 person employee companies together to a single record keeper, they might be able to use their collective purchasing power to say, your normal price is, for argument's sake, $1,000. We want you to do it for us for $800 because we're bringing you, you know, this bulk offering. So give it to us at a discounted rate. The other thing from an advisor perspective is it allows a streamline of operations, right? So today, where an advisor may have, you know, 40 or 50 plans that they service potentially, and each plan might have its own provisions and each plan might have its own funds that have to get reviewed, et cetera. That can all be streamlined down into a single fund lineup with potentially a single, you know, provision of plan offerings, such as whether it offers traditional accounts, Roth accounts, after tax monies, et cetera. The options of the plan can be streamlined across multiple businesses, whereas perhaps that wasn't the case before. And if this sounds like, gee, you know, well, that sounds like a good idea. Why didn't I see that before? Why didn't they do this ever in the past? The reason why is not because the Secure Act created MEPS. They've actually been around for many years. The reason is that the Secure Act removed barriers that prevented their adoption. And in particular, there were two primary barriers that existed prior to the Secure Act. The first one is commonly known as the one bad apple rule. And that was an IRS rule, which in short said, you know, let's go back to our imaginary MEP and say we have 100 businesses that participate inside this MEP. And one of them decides, you know what, we're not going to follow the rules. We're going to do something wrong. That one business could have disqualified the entire plan. Like all 100 companies would have seen their qualified plan monies evaporate simply because one company did not follow the rule. And obviously that is ridiculous, right? That what employer would potentially want to subject themselves to some other unknown employer's risk of not following the rules? And so that prevented a lot of people from adopting these. The Secure Act resolves that by essentially providing for cure provisions. If that one company doesn't do something right, the plan can, for simplicity's sake, they can boot that company out and go through some procedures to allow the remaining 99 companies to preserve their tax-preferenced assets. The second barrier to MEPS was a requirement that existed in ERISA for there to be a nexus for the companies. And for many, many years, that common nexus requirement was interpreted by the Department of Labor as essentially being companies in the same line of business, like, you know, multiple contractors participating as part of a single contractor MEP or so forth. Then in the middle of 2019, the Department of Labor actually by regulation changed its interpretation. Now, it can't change the law. The law can only be changed by Congress, but the administration can change its interpretation of the law. And that's what they did. The Department of Labor said, instead of like just a common business, we can go to, if you're in like the same state as another business, that'll be the nexus, or the same municipal area, that will be the nexus. The Secure Act takes that one step further and creates what are truly quote unquote open MEPs by eliminating the nexus requirement altogether. So today, a employer in, let's say, Alaska, whatever, they're farmers in Alaska. The farmer in Alaska can participate in the same MEP, if you will, as an accountant in Florida, as a contractor in New York, and you know, and so on and so forth. So that's the real benefit of these things. And I think we will certainly see a greater uptick in them going forward now that these barriers have been removed.
So who will sponsor these? How will eligibility for these be determined? And is it possible that we'll see some small employers who are using sort of a typical small company plan, so to speak, convert into an open MEP?
Yeah, I think that's entirely likely, particularly depending upon the type of savings and streamlined features that can be offered. And you know, the MEP can be established by any number of groups, but I think you're going to see potentially a push from advisors. I mean, if you're looking at this from an advisory perspective, instead of, again, having to like, you know, service all these different plans with different investment lineups, et cetera, I can go out there now and I can say, you know what, I'm going to create the Jeff Levine MEP, and I'm going to pick out the 20 best investment options that I believe are out there. And I'm going to do due diligence on just these every quarter, instead of doing it on, you know, 30 different fund lineups for different companies, et cetera. And then I will go out and market to the companies that I work with as clients to say, hey, why don't you participate in the Jeff Levine MEP, if you will? And there's a couple of ways you can run these. You can run these via like a board of directors or whatnot. But I think it will start at the advisory level. I think that's going to be a common place to do that. And I think a lot of this is also going to be based on the record keepers, because the record keepers out there don't necessarily benefit from the same streamlining as on the investment side, because plan testing still needs to be done at the company level, not at the MEP level. So you still have a lot of work on the part of the administrator. And so it's going to depend upon how, you know, there's going to be two sides to this equation, if you will. But sure, I think given the fact that the barriers have been reduced and there are some benefits for the creation, we are going to see a greater uptick. You certainly could have small business plans kind of converge onto these. That's really the pure target of this, if you will. You know, if you're just to throw out a company name, if you're like Home Depot, for argument's sake, you don't need a MEP in order to get, you know, pricing power. You're big enough as it is, right? You can go to any record keeper or plan, and they want your business simply because of your size and scale by yourself. So I do think those small businesses are probably the likely target.
So this presumably will have benefits for people working for smaller employers who either weren't covered by a plan before, or maybe it wasn't such a great plan. But I guess I can't help but wonder, isn't this a tremendously inefficient way to go about getting those people coverage? I mean, it always seemed like maybe just unifying the 401k IRA contribution limit, where if my 401k plan wasn't so good, I could put it all in an IRA. Wouldn't that sort of solve the problem, but maybe do it in a simpler way?
Yeah, I don't think any of this really simplifies the law. You know, that we've been kind of pushed, if you will, that a lot of these changes are being made for simplicity's sake. And I certainly don't see that. I mean, even going back to things like the changes in the stretch distributions, that doesn't change anything. All the same rules that existed before still exist today. Plus, now we have a new category of beneficiaries, you know, to spread those rules out across. So none of this really simplifies things. The argument in favor of MEPs is that if we can make plans cheaper, et cetera, then more companies will adopt them. You know, to me at this point, plans are so inexpensive that if you were an employer and you wanted to adopt one, I think you probably would have done it already. I don't really see this moving the needle that much. I think it's a great opportunity, you know, to streamline things for those who want to have plans. But I don't think this really moves the needle on a company saying, you know what, we weren't going to have one before, but now that we can, you know, participate in this MEP, yeah, we're definitely going to do it. I think you need things more either, like you said, to, you know, streamline things and make a kind of a more unified plan. And in fact, I was, you know, reading a couple articles on the Morningstar platform recently about the Universal American Retirement Plan or something along those lines.
Right. John Reckenthaler.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Which was, you know, great articles and really interesting, you know, idea about going about that essentially from the ground up. And I could see some benefits of that, you know, for where this, you know, if you want to get employers to adopt plans, you got to make it less expensive and less operationally burdensome for them. So the fact that they increase credits for small businesses, I think, is a bigger deal and potentially moves the needle more than these MEPs do. The credits will help more, and potentially we could see those, you know, increase further in future years. Also, the new rules for 401ks on mandatory requirement for participation for the long-term part-time employee. Again, that helps move the needle. That's going to get more people into the system. It doesn't help more businesses establish plans, but there's that separate provision of the Secure Act, which basically says where in the past, if you didn't work 1,000 hours in any year, you didn't have to be part of the 401k plan. The company could have had more lax rules, but they didn't have to include you. Going forward, there's a new requirement that says if you work 500 hours in any 3 consecutive years, so if you have kind of some long-time part-time workers, they now too will be required to be able to participate in those 401k plans. I think it's things like that that will further move the needle for the retirement savings issue that we see today.
The Secure Act will also make it easier for company retirement plans to offer annuities. Can you explain how that's so?
Sure. There's a couple of ways in which it does that. The first is a lot of 401k plans don't want to do that because they don't want the liability. And while they've long been an option. You know, there's nothing that has prevented people from prior to 2020, let's say, having an annuity inside a 401k as an investment option. Chances are, you know, your listeners haven't seen that in their plan. And that's because less than about 10% of plans actually incorporate them. And a large issue related to that was, hey, what if we have an annuity inside our plan, but in 20 years, you know, after, let's say 20 years after we've even stopped the plan, we've terminated the plan and there's no more business even, but 20 years down the road, you know, the annuity carrier goes belly up or something like that. You know, what happens? Are we still liable for it as the fiduciary of the plan? As I'm sure listeners are aware, you know, there's a very high bar when it comes to the ERISA fiduciary and what those fiduciary obligations require of the individuals who accept those roles, like plan trustees, et cetera. And so a lot of individuals just didn't want to take on that liability. You know, what if something happens down the road? How can we protect ourselves? Well, let's just not put it as an option in the plan. The SECURE Act attempts to go about addressing this by providing a procedure, a new safe harbor, if you will, for ERISA, that if the plan trustees follow and they follow a certain set of steps, they will receive a fair degree of liability insulation by following those steps via the safe harbor. And frankly, the steps are not that complicated. The first step is to do some level of due diligence on making sure that the insurer that you're looking at can meet their financial obligations, is in good status with the, you know, the state, is properly licensed, those types of things. And while all of that sounds really great, and it is certainly something that we would, you know, applaud and say, oh, good, then they have to do some, you know, do some legwork to verify the insurer's capacity to actually pay what they promised to pay. In what I think is probably one of the more egregious provisions of the SECURE Act, the way that can actually be done is by the plan trustees asking the insurance companies if they can meet their obligations. Like, all you have to do is get a warranty from the insurance companies themselves, a written statements. And while, you know, again, this is not to be anti-annuity, it's just the process itself is kind of backwards, right? It's kind of like asking, you know, having the fox guard the hen house, so to speak. Why would you ask the company who obviously has a clear benefit, if you will, from saying yes to come onto your plan if they can meet? Like, it's a little backwards. It really is. But nevertheless, that's the rule. The second aspect of that safe harbor is that the plan fiduciaries need to do a due diligence on the fees in respect to value. The SECURE Act goes out of its way to make sure and make abundantly clear that plan trustees have no obligation to select the lowest cost option, but they do have to make sure that the fees that are being charged by the annuity carrier are reasonable. And so, you know, for argument's sake, if there's a higher rated company that charges a slightly higher fee, maybe the plan trustee can, you know, justify that higher expense by simply saying they were a higher rated company and we felt that expense was worth it. So that's the first way in which the SECURE Act reduces barriers for annuities inside 401ks. The second way, the second primary way it does so, is kind of the opposite. Let's say that in the past, or even going forward, a trustee was comfortable enough to include an annuity in the plan, but at some point down the road, they changed their mind. You know, let's say today we decided we want to have ABC Insurance Company offer an annuity in the plan, but in 5 years, we decide that we no longer feel ABC is a good enough company to have in that plan and that there are either better options or we simply don't want an annuity option in the plan anymore for whatever reason. Well, in the past, that kind of created a real problem. Like, what do we do with this annuity? We can't like force a surrender because the participant may have surrender charges or there may be other issues. So it was a real dilemma. Going forward, the SECURE Act resolves that by essentially creating a distributable event for just that annuity when the plan decides that it no longer wants that annuity as an investment option in the plan. In short, and kind of to make that a little bit clearer, your company decides, you know what, we had this annuity option in the plan, you invested in it, but we don't really want to keep it as part of our fund lineup anymore. We're just going to end it, and instead of having this annuity distribute its assets, we will just carve out the annuity from your 401k. It'll be rolled over directly to an IRA annuity and kind of held intact. And so that's kind of how the SECURE Act resolves that issue of what if a plan decides to change its mind. And together, those two changes should reduce the barriers to annuities inside 401k plans to the point, you know, the reason this bill was probably passed was, you know, in all likelihood, due to its incredibly strong lobbying from the insurance industry.
I'm sure.
you can pretty well sense that those provisions were important to get those investments into a plan by virtue of just that.
Well, Jeff, you are an encyclopedia on retirement and tax planning matters. We've really loved the chance to sit down with you and to talk about this latest legislation. Thank you so much for taking time out of your schedule to be with us today.
Oh, of course. Again, thanks for having me and look forward to coming back sometime in the future.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thanks again. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us on The Long View. If you liked what you heard, please subscribe to and rate The Long View from Morningstar on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can follow us on Twitter at Christine_Benz.
And at SYouth1, which is SYouth and the number one.
Finally, we'd love to get your feedback. If you have a comment or a guest idea, please email us at thelongview@morningstar.com. Until next time, thanks for joining us.
This recording is for informational purposes only and should not be considered investment advice. Opinions expressed are as of the date of recording. Such opinions are subject to change. The views and opinions of guests on this program are not necessarily those of Morningstar Inc. and its affiliates. Morningstar and its affiliates are not affiliated with this guest or his or her business affiliates unless otherwise stated. Morningstar does not guarantee the accuracy or the completeness of the data presented herein. Jeff Patak is an employee of Morningstar Research Services, LLC. Morningstar Research Services is a subsidiary of Morningstar Inc. and is registered with and governed by the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. Morningstar Research Services shall not be responsible for any trading decisions, damages, or other losses resulting from or related to the information, data analyses, or opinions, or their use. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results. All investments are subject to investment risk, including possible loss of principal. Individuals should seriously consider if an investment is suitable for them by referencing their own financial position, investment objectives, and risk profile before making any investment decision.